tonight on Arena. Bumper crop of movies up for review, including The Matrix Resurrections, The Tragedy of Macbeth, and Licorice Pizza. +51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. So here we are in the winter solstice, almost into that strange week where space and time have little or no meaning. And we're embracing that spirit this evening here in Arena, inviting you to take the red pill and join us as we throw caution to the wind. We're reviewing movies on a Tuesday. Stay calm. We will review 5 movies this evening and we will have 3 reviewers to help us do so. What kind of a selection do we have for you? Well, Keanu Reeves returns in The Matrix Resurrections. Denzel Washington takes on the Scottish play directed by just one of the Coen brothers. Paul Thomas Anderson brings us Licorice Pizza. We look at The Humans, a story of a Thanksgiving get-together with a hint of a haunting. And we'll cast our eye over Titan, the controversial winner of the Palme d'Or at Cannes this summer. And as I said, a few extra critics with us this evening as well. John McGuire and Paul Whittington are here with me in studio. Angela Flannery joins us from the Arena Film Review Remote Outpost on this Tuesday evening. Full of it, aren't we? OK, let us start with, I suppose this is the big one. There are 5 big ones really in there, but this is the pretty big one. 20 years after the events of The Matrix Revolutions, in order to find out if his reality is a physical or a mental construct, Mr. Anderson, a.k.a. Neo, a.k.a. Keanu Reeves, will have to choose to follow the White Rabbit once more. Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss are starring here. Even as I read, to try to get my head around what happens in The Matrix, you know, which I thought I had left behind 3 decades ago, here I am again saying, can we kind of explain this, Paul? And do we need to know anything about the other Matrixes?
I think it would definitely help to have watched the first one, which was actually very good. I mean, it was a very interesting film. It did a lot of things technically and visually that hadn't been done before. It was prescient because that was the whole start of the internet thing, and there was a lot in that. And the story of it was Keanu Reeves' character, Neo, discovers to his horror that everything he sees is virtual and not real, and that machines are using pod people basically for energy, and so he becomes part of a rebellion. I think it would be useful to watch the first one, but you could probably watch this one and get away with it, because the plot is just makes you dizzy after a while, really.
Yeah, well, that's what all of the Matrix films do in some ways,
yes.
And I guess that's what they're designed to do in some ways. Angela, what kind of look do we have in this new version? Because if you think of that original Matrix film, 1999, the effects certainly then were revolutionary. Whoever thought a coat could do that, for example, or that a bullet could move so slowly. What are we getting here, Angela?
More of the same, Sean. And, you know, it's cyberpunk sci-fi, and the look is the same. The glasses are there, the coats are there, lots of ear piercings, lots of, you know, tattoos and all that, and all of the same special effects, the bullets stopping and, you know, the flying and the kung fu, all of that. But it is 22 years later, and I think that as an audience, what would have blown us away, and I mean, the original Matrix quite rightly won, what, 3 or 4 Oscars for sound, for editing, for special effects. We have really high expectations now, all these years on. And as you said, it's still Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss. And they're 22 years older, and they've got a much younger supporting cast. There's quite a few new cast members here, most notably Jessica Henwick as Bugs. And we don't have Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus. He's been replaced by Yahya Abdul-Mateen. So much younger, physically much more appealing and much more, you know, agile. And they end up making Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss look like the middle-aged people that they are.
I was going to say at one point when you were speaking there, there's a hint of tiredness in your voice, Angela, regarding this film. It's not a hint at all. John, are you in a similar boat to Angela?
I'm not really. The great irony of Matrix Resurrections is that this is a film that was once so appealing for being bleeding edge, that kind of cutting edge technology that it had, the storytelling form that it took, and it was designed to melt your head. And now it's been strip mined for whatever nostalgia value it might contain. And that, to me, is, first of all, a sign that it could still be 1999 and we are living in a simulation, because the thing is in an almost identical rehash of the first film.
Well,
but the other point being that it hasn't changed. And not only has it not changed, but it's the reference to itself makes this a really interesting film. It's a film about the three films. Now, they've changed them from movies to video games within Resurrections, but that the film has become self-aware in the same way as the machines in the story became self-aware.
All right,
and well, I think that's really interesting.
Okay, let's have a listen to a clip from Matrix Resurrections. Keanu Reeves as Neo is on the top of a building. Is this familiar? Jessica Henwick as Bugs. You'll never guess what she's going to do.
I fly, or I fall. Who the hell are you?
You won't remember me. But a long time ago, you changed my life. When you leapt off another roof. Back then, I was just like any other Coppertop, pretending my life. Until I looked up, and I saw you. It was a different you, but I saw the real you. Just a second before you leapt. And you never fell. I knew one day I would find you. And that when I did, you would be ready for this. If you want the truth, Neo, you're going to have to follow me.
Okay.
Yeah, Keanu Reeves as Neo there and Jessica Henwick as Bugs. I've been told in studio here, Angela, that I'm not entering into the spirit of it by Paul Whittington. And John Maguire similarly kept telling me to kind of get with the message. I think you and I might be in a similar boat on this one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this film, there, you know, come with me to find out the truth. That is the motivation. That's the only motivation in it. You know, it's a film about memory. John's quite right there when he talks about it being self-referential. And, you know, while he may have enjoyed that, I didn't. And what I really thought was that actually an awful lot of people who will go to see this who are Matrix fans, and it is one of those films that to a whole generation of cinema goers, like, so hugely influential. They could break down every scene in it, every character arc in it, and this kind of replaying scenes from the past movies, you know, it is necessary to jog the memories of older people like me, but also to fill in the gaps for a new, younger audience. You know, it's 22 years ago. But I think that that will really irritate some people who are super fans of the Matrix franchise.
So, Paul, how do I then get into the spirit of things, seeing as that is the command that you gave me while we were listening?
Try harder, Sean. Actually, no, I actually don't have any great affection for the 1999 one, I have to say. I mean, I thought it was very original, as Angela and John have said, and it was visually original and so on. But I always thought that it was very thin, and I still think that. So having no expectations, with nothing underneath, I rather enjoyed this one. I think Angela's slightly unkind to poor old Keanu, who's a very spry, whatever he is, 57. And I think the way it all works around him is okay. I was expecting it not to be good. I kind of enjoyed it, especially the opening bit that John refers to, all of sort of the self-referencing and stuff. I thought that was kind of interesting, actually. Yeah.
Okay, so let me get a kind of a summary and a stars from each of you then. I'll start with you, John.
Whether the material is dated badly or I'm dating myself badly by referencing it like this, but this is like a greatest hits album from a cover band. It's fun for fans, but a rehash for the casual viewer. So if you're not really into The Matrix, I don't know if you're going to have a good time. I really enjoyed the 1999 film. It came at that time. It revolutionized how we watched films, but also because it was the dawn of the internet and The Matrix was designed for the internet, it changed how we talked about film as well at that time, at the turn of the millennium. And suddenly we had a lot more information and a lot more analysis of what the film was trying to talk about. So I like all of that. I do like all of that. And I, think, I like like the fact that we get to go over it again.
Okay. I think that greatest hits analogy is one that you appeals to you as well, Angela.
Well, I'm not sure that it appeals to me, but it is an analogy that I also drew from this. I just found it a little bit lazy in that way, kind of bring everyone together for this reboot, you know, back to the box office. That's really what it felt like to me. But there was one part of it that I enjoyed, and it was a really unusual piece of casting that I wasn't expecting. It was Neil Patrick Thomas as the analyst, who is, you know, Tom, a.k.a. Neo's therapist, who's giving him, you know, the pills that will make him forget, or, you know, that will make him be able to deal with these paranoid delusions that he's having. This actor, I really wasn't expecting to see there. He, you know, for years he was in that TV sitcom, the American one, How I Met Your Mother, as Barney, the Eternal Bachelor. And he plays, you know, he's essentially the villain in the movie. And I kind of thought, I liked him.
Okay.
You know, that appealed to me. But other than that, I really just, like, 2.5 hours went quite quickly. So
Stars?
If you haven't seen The Matrix 2.
Two from you, and it sounds as if the actor's getting at least one of those. Paul,
I like
you
the
saying?
Cat too.
You like the cat?
Neil Patrick, he's a cat. The significance of which was entirely lost on me because I'm too dim to figure out what the cat was about. Maybe being less engaged by the original film than the other two, I didn't mind this. It was a little bit long. I won't hear a word said against Keanu, so 3 stars.
Well, I was going to say, and nobody has even questioned the man's acting ability once.
No. That sort of slightly bemused acting style that he has suits
sailed.
This very well. Yes.
Right, let us move on then to the tragedy of Macbeth. Joel Coen has made a film without his brother. First time he's done that, in fact. The movie is The Tragedy of Macbeth. Stars Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand as the murderously ambitious Thane of Cawdor and his lady wife. You take on a story or a play and a film version of Macbeth, Angela. You're taking on quite a lot to try to do something new. Joel Coen has set himself quite a task, hasn't he?
Yeah, he absolutely has. And I think that while he doesn't have Ethan there, he has a formidable sidekick in his wife, Frances McDormand, who plays Lady Macbeth and who produces this. And I think actually it was her ambition for this to happen. And look, you know, there are differences with the original text, and I think that they actually, you know, they really do make the film. I found this captivating from the very, very beginning. It's a beautiful looking film. There's great performances in it. Denzel Washington as Macbeth, Bertie Carvel as Banquo, Brendan Gleeson as Duncan, and then the British theatre actor Alex Hassell as Ross, which captivated me. But most interestingly, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are a couple in advanced middle age, which is so unusual. And that, you know, really kind of plays on the whole idea of time and of legacy and of impotence rather than power, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, that is it. I mean, so often this is it's a young couple that you see playing the two Macbeths, Paul.
Yes.
The older actors here, it's not about ambition that they're highly ambitious. It's almost like the ambition thwarted that hasn't been realised somehow, and they're frustrated.
Yeah, you that's right, John. You get the feeling this is their last chance, and it creates a sort of inbuilt sympathy for them that might not be there otherwise. And when Macbeth first appears, like, he kind of swaggers on, but his knees are a bit gone, you know, like an old sportsman. He's sick of fighting. And when Duncan says, you know, you're Thane of Cawdor, he takes that as an insult because he thinks he deserves more. And while this is usually played as, you know, the crafty female egging him on, it's his idea first to have a go at the king. She's going to stop him when he falters. But her performance is really interesting because she is a person thwarted, a bright woman wandering the halls of an empty castle. She hasn't had children at that point. The sole purpose of marriage was to create heirs so that families could keep their land. So she feels that failure keenly, and this is just the last chance at any kind of significance.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip featuring Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth. At this stage, Hamlet is kind of dithering over whether he's going to do away with Duncan or not. Incidentally, played by Brendan Gleeson, we'll come back to that. And Macbeth in this clip, obviously, Denzel Washington, who we are going to hear.
Art thou afeard to be the same in thine own act and valour as thou art in desire? Wouldst thou have that which thou esteem'st the ornament of life, and live a coward in thine own esteem? letting I dare not wait upon I would, like the poor cat in the adage?
Prithee, peace. I dare do all that may become a man. Who dares do more is none.
What beast was then made you break this enterprise to me? When you durst do it, then you are a man. And to be more than what you were, you would be so much more the man. I have given suck, and know how tender 'tis to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out, had I so sworn as you had done to this.
If we should fail.
We fail. But screw your courage to the sticking place and we'll not fail.
And there we have Frances McDormand and Denzel Washington as Lady Macbeth and Macbeth, respectively, in The Tragedy of Macbeth, Joel Coen's new realisation of the Shakespeare play. And he's really, I mean, it's difficult to take a Shakespeare play. Macbeth, I'm pretty certain, is the shortest of the Shakespearean tragedies. So it's the easier one.
Still
to,
about 3 hours long, though, isn't it?
To get to the screen, but you still have a lot, as Paul says, a lot of cutting back.
Yeah, they say it's about 1,000 an hour, you know, that you get 1,000 lines in an hour and there's 2,500 lines in Macbeth, and so it should be about 2.5 hours. This is a lot tighter than that, and that's what Coen has done, is really trimmed it down to its bare essentials. We haven't really talked about the staging and the setting of this film. It's gorgeous. It just looks gorgeous. Everything is concrete, straight lines, minimalist, modernist. It feels ancient and very new. But the photography from Bruno Debonnel, who's worked with the Coens before, is just spectacular, monochrome, black and white. It just glows off the screen. I absolutely love that aspect of it. But it can look as nice as it wants. You need the performances. You need the power. You need your Macbeth. You need your Lady Macbeth. You need all the people around them. You need all. There's no hiding place when you do Shakespeare. They all have to be right on it. And that's what happens here. They are superb.
That setting is quite interesting, because in some ways, and you know, someone who has a bit of a background in theatre, I thought, why am I kind of saying this is a bit stagey? But it's a set. It's not. We're not on a location somewhere. We're quite definitely. It feels as if it's a film of a theatre production.
I think it's very deliberately staged, and I think that then allows him to do what he does with the witches, the weird sisters, as they're called, because you know, one appears, and also sex indeterminate. I know the it's an actress, but it's very interesting. And then one appears, and two more appear in water in front of him. It's beautiful, and then they keep turning into crows and so forth. That's absolutely beautifully done. That type of thing wouldn't have been possible had it been more sort of realistic.
Catherine Hunter, another theatre actress. She's a long career in the theatre, and she is amazing.
She's really frightening, and it's
a scary story. Yeah. That's the point. That's the point.
She plays all three. Let's listen to her, and her physicality is extraordinary. She kind of contorts herself into ways that I can't believe that a person can do. Let's listen to her, I suppose, with one of the really famous speeches from the witches.
By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes.
Oh, now, you secret black and midnight hags. What is't you do?
A deed without a name.
I conjure you, by that which you profess, however come to know it, answer me, even till destruction sicken. Answer me to what I ask you.
Speak, demand. We'll answer.
Save thou'st rather hear it from our mouths or from our masters.
Call him. Let me see him.
Double, double, toil and trouble. Fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Double, double, toil and trouble.
And that's Catherine Hunter as all three of the weird sisters in The Tragedy of Macbeth, the Joel Coen realisation of the Shakespeare play. Angela, I mean, her voice there is extraordinary. And while I was talking about staginess, it's in the setting. There's no staginess in any of the performances. They're all really finely tuned.
Yeah, they are. And I mean, he's used theatre actors who are experienced in performing Shakespeare to great effect. She was amazing. And the idea of, you know, having one actor play the three weird sisters, and that's, you know, really frightening, you know, sense of magic and the supernatural and how surrealism is used. I mean, I looked, it is so beautiful, as John says, that, you know, the monochrome and the light and the clean lines, and it's really, really extraordinary to look at from almost a photographic point of view, particularly those, how do you manage to make those scenes with the witches and what they're conjuring up? And are they hallucinatory or are they not? It is done so beautifully. And it just put me in mind of Magritte or of Man Ray. It was like so artistic, but not, you know, just really, really kind of, awesome, quite frankly. The performances were great. I loved Alex Hassel as Ross. Now, I mean, I know Macbeth fairly well as a play, and traditionally he's a messenger who kind of, you know, delivers news, and it's kind of more of a plot device where he moves things along. But, you know, he has a different agenda in this entirely. And I just thought it was really interesting because it adds on a kind of subplot. How much does he know? Why is he always so near the crime? It made me question Lady Macbeth's suicide. I'm not going to give anything away about, you know, the final scene, but it... Yeah, I was kind of blown away by it. I thought, oh my, I'm seeing Macbeth in a different way.
The shifting loyalties of Ross are always an interesting aspect of the play, but Coen does something with that shifting loyalty that makes you kind of wonder, how powerful a character is Ross? Stars from you, Angela.
Oh, five, undoubtedly. Five.
Undoubtedly five. Paul Whittington, what are you saying?
Yeah, if you're going to do this, you have to do something different with it. Justin Kurzel, in his, which was very good, actually, he made it into a slasher film, which is perfectly reasonable. But it's a ghost story told in monochrome, and it's fantastic. I'd watch it again right now, five stars.
Yeah. Five from you, John?
The one niggling doubt when you see an interpretation of Shakespeare is, why are you doing it? Why is Joel Coen making this film? Although I really enjoyed this movie and I loved watching it, I loved the experience and I loved what I was thinking about afterwards, that niggling doubt remained. Why is he doing it? What does he have to add?
You mentioned Orson Welles, John, as well. He's kind of, there's a big influence
there. There is that from the voodoo Welles, the voodoo Macbeth that Welles did in the 1930s. And they asked him that question too, but Welles had an all-black cast and he was doing it in the Federal Theatre in New York for that specific reason, to show that at that time in the 1936, that black people could act just as well as white people. Coen has a diverse cast and it's a blind cast. I mean, you know, we never mentioned it. No. It goes without mention.
Accents are irrelevant.
It's all completely irrelevant. They're just the Shakespearean characters. But I still had that niggling doubt why is he doing this? But it's four stars. I mean, you have to watch it.
Apple
TV.
Okay, so the Matrix Resurrections, which opens in cinemas tomorrow, and The Tragedy of Macbeth opens in cinemas on Sunday, December the 26th, in Stephen's Day. Those are our first two films, but we have three more to come shortly. All right, let us move on then to the third of our five film reviews on this Tuesday evening, Licorice Pizza, Paul Thomas Anderson. We're in the 1970s. Where else would Paul Thomas Anderson ever bring us, John McGuire?
This is Paul Thomas Anderson's latest film. As you say, Sean, Licorice Pizza is latest and I think one of his greatest films. It's the story of two 1970s Californian kids. You've got the 15, 16-year-old child actor, entrepreneur and high school student Gary, who's played by Cooper Hoffman. Mm. The son of Philip Seymour Hoffman, one of Anderson's regular collaborators. And you've got the disillusioned 25-year-old Alana, played by Alana Haim from the band Haim. And they meet cute and they stay cute throughout a series of kind of harebrained schemes, misadventures, scrapes, fallings out, chasing around. There's a lot of running in this film. They run every which way, all over Encino in California in the 1970s. It's all very playful, very heartwarming. And then it has this kind of steely core right at the center of it, which is beautifully played throughout that, and so beautifully developed throughout the whole,
The whole movie. Anja hasn't seen this. I'm just going to stick with you two, obviously, for this one, Paul. This is a coming-of-age story on the surface of it, but it seems to be going somewhere a little bit deeper than just, boy and girl grow up.
There's an awful lot going on in this, actually, and you really have to think about it for quite a while after it, and it's very funny at times early on, which kind of draws you into it, and it has a warmth to it. But I think it is a love story, but it's about innocence versus corruption, and the beautiful thing, this pair's relationship is so innocent that it's not consummated, so far as we know, during the film, which obviously, legally would be problematic, not in the 70s but now, but they remain innocent, and all around them is the cesspool of 1970s Hollywood, and we meet various characters, iterations. This character based on poor old William Holden, I don't think he deserves this this performance by Sean Penn, but he's this kind of middle-aged sort of movie star, and his chat-up lines are just strung together cliches from his films. And she says, Alana says, I don't understand, is this real? And it's a good question, because nothing around them is, but somehow they stay innocent, and that's the sort of beauty of the film for me.
Yeah, and there's something very touching about the fact that it is Cooper Hoffman who's playing in this. John,
he's very good.
Really?
I mean, this is his first time as a first time acting.
Yeah,
Alana Haim is the same. She'd never really acted before. I mean, she'd done music videos and things like that. But you've got two first time actors. Mm. You can't take your eyes off either of them all the way through. I think he's brilliant because as a 15, 16 year old serial entrepreneur, and he's got his hand in all these different pies. He's into waterbeds. He's into pinball machines. And he's a child actor, and he's going on to New York to do things on TV, and it's all very cheesy. And you kind of don't like him.
Yeah.
You know, he's too wholesome on one side, but he's also got, he's kind of dislikable as well. And that's a really interesting thing for a young actor to play on that knife edge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then she just blows him out of the water. Yeah. She's superb in this film. Really extraordinary performance.
It is.
Bradley Cooper is in here as well. Where does he fit into the story, Paul? Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, Bradley plays. It's a real character, isn't it? I mean, supposed to be.
Yeah, John Peters is a real person.
I don't know how. John Peters apparently okay. I don't think he was as bad as this, but he's this producer, and he's an absolute pig. Like, he's gone around, you know, punching strangers and having these, you know, absolute meltdowns, and then talking really calmly and going around seducing people. He's an example of the kind of the rocks that await this couple, who are the two most innocent people in the film and remain so, but we can't understand. And how almost. She is amazing in it. I think, I don't know yet whether she's going to just be really, really good at playing this character or a really, really good actress, but she is just fascinating in this film. Yeah. And her character, one of her sisters says to her at one point, you've got to stop arguing with everybody. She tells her to F off, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's really funny. She's just all this energy and all this potential, and nobody's used it yet.
Yeah. Right. The arch of her eyebrow alone in certain scenes. That's all she has to do is raise an eyebrow, and she communicates exactly what the character has to say.
Given that they are both first-time actors, as you're saying, yeah, we have to give Anderson some
credit. Absolutely, I do. Absolutely, I do.
And the writing as well, Jonas.
And he's trying to eulogise that kind of California state of mind that was, you know, that Tarantino was trying to tap into as well with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
It's been very attractive to filmmakers, hasn't it?
Exactly. And it's not just about recreating the California of the time, but it's the attitudes and the mores of the time as well.
And of cinema of the time as well, the looseness of cinema.
That's it. It's a very Robert Altman movie. Altman, of course, was Anderson's great mentor, and he worked with him on a couple of films. He was his assistant on a couple of films. And there's that overlapping dialogue and the camera work and all that kind of stuff is very Altman. But you've got this kind of collision between the high school kids hangout movie, and then people like John Peters and Sean Penn turn up, and they're on a completely different thing altogether, on a completely different Hollywood altogether, and that's a really interesting collision.
All right, stars from you, John.
Oh, five. This is one of Anderson's best films.
This is a proper great movie.
This is as good as things like There Will Be Blood and so forth. I think it's very, very strong. Yeah, five.
Yeah, I loved it.
If I could give it 5.5, I would. I just thought it was a great, great film.
Yeah, the music is sensational. We didn't mention the soundtrack.
No.
Yeah. The soundtrack is sensational.
Yeah, it is, and very well used as well.
Of the period, is it? Of the 70s, yeah.
Yes, it is. And what's that Paul McCartney song, Roll With It? That's used brilliantly in one sequence. He knows how to use music, and it's really cleverly done.
Okay, so two fives.
Two fives.
Yeah. Wow, there we go.
Licorice Pizza, it opens 1st of January, I think, Sean.
Yes, it is.
In selected cinemas, and 7th of January nationwide. So it'll go nationwide. Okay, everybody will get a chance to see.
The new year, trusting that all things will be still happening in the new year, that will be when we'll get to see Licorice Pizza. Right, let us move on to film number 4 this evening. Set inside a duplex in downtown Manhattan, The Humans follows the course of an evening in which the Blake family gathers to celebrate Thanksgiving. As darkness falls outside the old building, mysterious things start to go bump in the night and family tensions reach a boiling point. Angela, this has it sounds to me as if it has a touch of a ghost story. And ghost stories are maybe, if you think of Christmas Carol, ghost stories are more common around Christmas time than we might think until we think for longer than 2 seconds.
Yeah, a ghost story, is it? Yeah, the people are definitely haunted, but what are they haunted by? Their own kind of existential angst. I mean, you've got a family here where you've got them, a mother and father. The mother is played by Jane Houdeshell, the father by Richard Jenkins. Then we have Amy Schumer as Amy, the older sister, and Beanie Feldstein as the younger sister. And then their grandmother, who's played by June Squibb, Momo, who's in a wheelchair and has advanced Alzheimer's. So, I mean, you know, ghost story, I've heard this described as horror, but it's the horror of the human mind, really, is, and the horror of being put together. I mean, I hate to say this a couple of days before Christmas, but with your family around a table and a turkey and with very deep-seated kind of resentments, it's a very well-worn story of family dysfunction. But underneath it all, you know, these people wouldn't choose to be with anybody else, and they constantly express their gratitude before they then turn around and tear strips off each other. So that's where we are in a very grotty, rundown duplex in Chinatown that the younger daughter, Bridget, played by Beanie Feldstein, has moved into with her relatively new boyfriend, Richard, who is Korean-American. And the parents, who are of Irish Catholic stock, arrive into Manhattan from Scranton, Pennsylvania, to celebrate Thanksgiving with their two daughters and the new boyfriend. That's the scenario.
And I suppose the other aspect of this is, in America in particular, Paul, family gets together on Thanksgiving. They can have a big row because they can make up come Christmas time. But I get the impression that this family will have another go at each other come Christmas time.
Well, I think what's interesting about them is that they're an ordinarily dysfunctional family, and the poor boyfriend, like, having to put up with a lot of them. But they only ordinarily, and there are various secrets that come to light, as they always do in dramas. But you get this feeling that they're going to stick together, that they are going to forgive each other. I think the interesting thing about this is most adapted plays, especially by the people who wrote them, they just fall flat. They stick to the stage as films. This doesn't, because he's imagined a way into it. And it's this Kafka-esque house. That's exactly what it's like. And interestingly, you can never quite figure out the geography of it. Mm. And that adds to the general kind of misery and psychological confusion. But it's also very funny, though.
What about the apartment or the house itself?
Yeah, the place is a dump. It's an absolute dump.
But is it an almost character in a character in the movie?
This is how...
What's that lump in the wall, John?
Stephen Karam is the writer and director, and it was his. He won a Tony for the play, and that's how you expand it. You turn this, what would have been a stage setting, you turn that into the character, and there's all kinds of drips and creaks and strange, like Paul says, a very strange geography in the rooms that they're in. They don't have any furniture. The young couple have just moved in, so it's almost bare, but it's not quite, because there's stains on the walls. It hasn't been redeveloped. And then they've got this, what they call in the early scenes, the internal courtyard, which is just like this chimney of light that's outside the windows, the only place you can get a phone signal. And that's really unnerving as well. So the setting becomes a character as well. But the one character that I really responded and is very clever in the film, which wouldn't work quite so well on the stage, is Richard, who's played by Steven Yeun, who's in Minari. He took the lead in Minari. And he's the outsider. He's Korean-American. He's not Irish, Roman Catholic. And he's a convenient wall against which they all bounce whatever problems they have going on. He's the eyewitness. Right. He's our eyes.
He's the boyfriend stage. Character.
He's the boyfriend character. And you've got these 30 years of the Blake family's repressed traumas and
he's gonna have
grudges and secrets and lies. Yeah. And he's got to deal. And it all flowers then into catharsis in the final act, which I think is just superbly done.
Yes, and superbly done. Delicate in how I might ask about whatever about dealing with one's own family. He has to deal with his loved one's family, which is a whole different ballgame. Angela, John picking out the character of the boyfriend there, were there other characters or the performances that stood out for you?
Yeah, I absolutely agree about the Richard character. I kind of wondered, Jesus, just go up and go to the corner deli and get a pint of milk and don't come back. Run, get out there, you know. But he doesn't, and we need him there because they tell him the backstories of the other characters. And you end up, you know, no matter how much of a horror show it is, absolutely identifying. They're so authentic to their bone. It's all of these characters. You just care about them. You are so invested in them. But the performances that stood out for me were the parents. Well, actually, do you know, people will say Amy Schumer is in this and they go to it and they think it's going to be a laugh a minute kind of situation comedy. It is so dark. She's got chronic colitis and her heart is broken because her girlfriend has left her. I mean, and she's amazing in it. But I think that Richard Jenkins as Eric the father. Now, he's a character actor who's done this kind of role before. He played Henry Kittredge in the miniseries Olive Kittredge opposite Frances McDormand. And it is that kind of man getting to a stage in his life wondering, how did this all go so wrong? And at one point he goes, why does it cost so much to be alive? And your heart just goes out to him. But also Jane Houchel, who plays the mother Deirdre, I mean, she is such a weapon. I mean, really just so passive aggressive. You know, she brings her daughter and the Korean American boyfriend a housewarming gift of a Blessed Virgin statue. You know, it's just
very touching.
You know, you couldn't make it up.
No.
And her performance is extraordinary. But she plays, she's been in the Broadway production of this, I think, for years. Look, it just I was so impressed by this film. I enjoyed every single minute of it, even though it is a horror show.
Right, let's get a quick roundup of stars. Angela first.
Well, do you know, I was kind of going between 4 and 5 because I did find all of the camera work around the blistering paintwork and the banging pipes. And I know that that's there to, you know, and that you can't get the phone signal and all of that. It just did begin to wear on me, which I think was the purpose of it. But I'd be pushing towards a 5 with this because the performances are extraordinary.
4 and 3/4, that sounds very like. Well. Well, heading towards a 5 is what you're saying, but not quite there yet. Is that where you are with it?
Maybe before
the end of the item, you'll be at 5. Paul, stars just?
Yeah, I would feel the same as Angela, really. I think I did give it 5 stars because I've submitted my copy for the paper, and I'd probably stick with that because I know it's a lot of 5 stars. We're being very positive here.
Very generous.
But it is generous, even though it's stage-based, because its message is very dark, and yet it's very generous in its writing in terms of the characters, you know.
John?
If this sounds like the kind of film that you like, you'll really like this because it's a top-notch example of the form. So I gave it 4 stars. I had a very good time watching
All
it.
Right.
I really got into it.
You really have had a good time so far. I don't know whether it's the Christmas spirit or whatever, but certainly the three of you seem to have enjoyed yourself for the most part. Let's move on then to our final one for this evening, Titan, written and directed by Julia Ducournau. Stars Agathe Roussel in her feature film debut as Alexia, a woman who, after being injured in a car accident as a child, has a titanium plate fitted into her head. The film had its world premiere at the Cannes Film Festival in July, where Ducournau became the second female director to win the Palme d'Or. How much of the plot do you need to give me on top of what I've just said for us to be able to discuss it here, Angela?
Well, I suppose, yes, the accident happens when she's a child, and that's the opening scene. And then we go forward around about 20 years thereabouts, and Alexia is now in exotic dancer in a kind of classic car showroom come nightclub, and she performs on top of a car. But what we don't know about her is she's got a terrible secret. She's a serial killer, and this all becomes apparent when an obsessed fan follows her after her shift dancing and forcibly tries to kiss her, and she responds by pulling out her hairpin that's holding her chignon up very stylishly, and she lodges it into him, and we go, aha, okay. Right. Then we learn she's been doing this for a while.
Ducournau, you could argue, has been doing this for a while as
well, right,
John,
yeah,
because her debut film Raw divided audiences because of the violence.
I was really into Raw. That was her first film.
Maybe it didn't divide us. Certainly didn't divide,
divide us anyway. And that had a vegetarian heroine who developed this insatiable appetite for human flesh and primal sex and all the rest of it.
But does
and
Titan
it repelled
fit in?
A lot of people.
Does Titan fit into that pattern?
I think it makes Raw look like a glass of water is what it does. I mean, this is absolute balls to the wall. There's no, she doesn't hold back here at all. And it taps into that kind of late 90s, early 2000s French extreme new wave that predominantly female filmmakers, actually, like Catherine Burriat, they made these films that were really extreme and really hardcore at that period, maybe 20 odd years ago. And here we have a director who could do whatever she wants, but she's fascinated by these kind of horror stories, the body horror stories, mutilations, violence. She plays around with all of that kind of material But there's no story here. I didn't get anything out of the story whatsoever. I was repelled, but I wasn't at any point interested.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, as John said. I mean, with Raw, yes, it was repulsive to watch, but it was fascinating and it was really well done. It was really interesting, and that was her debut film, I think.
So does this feel gratuitous, Titan?
It just feels a bit daft, to be perfectly honest. I mean, no spoilers. She manages to have sex with the Cadillac, and then she's on the run and she's pretending to be male, and she pitches up at this fire and rescue place and pretends to be the missing son of Vincent Landon, who's a great French character actor. And so there's lots of stuff going on, but it's just nothing is earned. The horror seems gratuitous because, as John says, there's nothing holding it together. I'm not sure what she was trying to do here.
Although the thing for you, Angela, that in fact the Landon character that Paul has mentioned there, who's also called Vincent in the film, that he did bring a kind of a humanity to the film for you?
Yeah, he did. I mean, what we haven't said is that she is pregnant after having sex with the car.
Yeah.
Right. So what is she pregnant with? Is it a car? Is it a baby? Is it, you know, a cyborg of some kind? So, yeah, Vincent Landon's character is a man whose son has gone missing and whose son would now be around the same age as Alexia. And so she pretends to evade capture, cuts her hair, breaks her own nose, disguises herself, straps down her breasts and her increasingly large pregnant belly, and, you know, impersonates his son. And it was really kind of, I found that really interesting that this, you know, Vincent character is willing to accept her. And you know from the beginning that he knows it's not his son, but that's, it becomes something about grief and self-delusion and fatherhood. And he is a great actor. And so he was able to carry that. And I started caring about him. I was like, what's going to happen with him? At one point, his wife, ex-wife, estranged wife, shows up. She cops on what's happening and says to the Alexia character, because she sees her belly and all of that, whatever you do, don't hurt him. And she lets the pretense go on. And I kind of felt that about him as well. But there is one great scene, comic scene in it around CPR that made the film worth watching for me. But I absolutely agree with Paul and John. I was kind of lost going, what's the point of this?
Stars,
I can't relate.
Stars.
Two.
Yeah, I think if this is going to be a nasty one all round.
Yeah, it'd be two for me as
two
well.
Two from you as well, Paul. Yeah, not much. Yeah,
you can do better.
See, I'm a sucker for controversy baiting spectacle. I'm okay with being wrong-footed constantly. I did not know what was going to happen next when I was watching this movie, and I couldn't imagine what was going to happen next. And she keeps showing you these horrible, horrible visions. Yes, it doesn't tie together, but there's still stuff in here that you're never going to see anywhere else. So three for me.
Three, okay. I thought you were going to go a lot.
And it won at Cannes as well, but that's classic. They love this kind of, you know.
It's a very Cannes movie.
So let me just tell you about the three that we've been speaking about in this part of the programme. Titan and the Humans open on December the 30th. First, Licorice Pizza, as we said, January the 1st, and then a broader release later in the month of January. The Matrix Resurrection, cinemas tomorrow. The Tragedy of Macbeth, cinemas on Sunday. But as we have the three of you here, why don't we get your film of the year, film of 2021, not just from the fact that you've been watching this evening. John.
Dune, the Denis Villeneuve Dune. We managed eventually to get to see it. And
it was worth the wait.
Worth the wait. It blew me away when I watched it. I'm a science fiction fan. I'm a Dune fan. I'm a Villeneuve fan. I think what he did, no more than what Joel Coen does, strip it down to its bare elements and deliver it. And I think he did a beautiful job.
John Maguire says Dune. Paul Whittington?
I'm kind of torn. I liked Power of the Dog very much. It was a very strong film. And I think Licorice Pizza just is great, and it grows on me. But I love Tragedy of Macbeth.
It really did appeal to
me now, I have to say.
All right, it's kind of heading towards Tragedy. Well, Tragedy of the Macbeth is what you're saying, okay, as your film of the year. And Angela, finally, please.
I didn't know that I could choose one that we were reviewing tonight. So I was kind of torn between, you know, Mads Mikkelsen had a great year. Another Round was fantastic. Mm. And so was Riders of Justice. But, you know, when I really thought about it, actually, I think it's The Father, which Anthony Hopkins won the Best Actor Oscar for. Yeah. I just thought it was so, powerful and moving, and did really interesting things in terms of the cinematography, messing with our perception. And so that eventually we really were looking at at, you know, the world of this apartment from the just from the perspective of, you know, an elderly man who's totally confused.
All right.
And it was so skillfully done. Yeah. So I think the father for
and
me.
And he deserved his Oscar, didn't he? Sure. That's Angela Flannery's choice, The Father. John Maguire's choice, Dune. Paul Whittington's choice, The Tragedy of Macbeth. And thank you to all three. Happy Christmas to
Happy
all
Christmas,
three.
Happy
and we'll see you in 2022. Now, if you were to ask anybody with an interest in traditional Irish music to name some of the greatest Pipers of all time, I think you'd hear names like Liam O'Flynn, Paddy Maloney. Maybe earlier in the 20th century, you'd go to people like Seamus Ennis, Leo Rosum. Further back, 19th century, Patsy Toohey. Yeah, Liam, Paddy, Leo, Seamus, Patsy. You've worked it out, every single one of them a man. But a new documentary which aired on T.G. Cahir on Sunday night, now available on the T.G. Cahir player, aims to explore the lives and contributions of the women who have been airbrushed out of the history of the pipes. Manon the Beeb, presented by one of Ireland's leading pipers, Louise Mulcahy, who joins me now. When you were first introduced, Louise, to the pipes in your teens, How broad a church was it at that time? I mean, did we have good representation of both male and female players?
Hi, Sean. How are you? Well, for sure, when I started playing in the 90s, there were very few girls playing, very few women. And often I was the only girl in the Uilleann piping classes attending the Pibrí Uilleann in Dublin. But I was aware, I suppose I grew up in a very musical household and my father, of course, a great musician. I was aware from a very young age of the importance of the history of the music. And so when I started playing, my father connected me to a publication called O'Neill's Irish Minstrels and Musicians, published in 1913 by Captain Francis O'Neill. And within that book, there were a number of references to women pipers. And I think from that, from the outset, I always had so many questions about it. But it was obvious. I knew of Marnie Grothe, of course, who was playing Mary Mitchell and Marion McCarthy. But there were very few, very thin on the ground when I was playing. And of course, very few playing professionally at that time as well.
Yeah, and Marnie Grothe, as you mentioned, I suppose associated pretty much with the Cork Irish Pipers Club, and that it seems to be that Munster, in fact, for some reason, was very well represented when it came to women pipers or female pipers.
For sure, there was a real tradition of piping, and it was seen as nothing unusual in Cork City. But then the Cork Pipers Club was the first institution to teach Irish music. And so we see a huge group of women pipers emerging from there, more so than any other part of the country. But one particular woman, who was the catalyst and who set the media into frenzy, was a member of the Cork Pipers Club, and that was Anna Barry. And we have it documented in the newspaper that she inspired six other women to take up the pipes in Cork City. So a very important figure, and we all know that if there's a presence or a visibility, it often inspires other people to take up the instrument. So perhaps that's one of the reasons as well why there are more women playing in Cork. She seems to have been the first in that iconic image of 1901. The adjudicator of the day called her a dove amongst a flock of frowsy old crows, you know.
There's another great character in all of this, a woman called Mae McCarthy.
Very inspiring and groundbreaking, really. And she was a member of the Cork Pipers Club as well. And she was a dancer, but she also played the war pipes. But she continued playing right up until her death. And she set up a Cayley band. She taught music. And she was part of the Gaelic League and Cúnamh League, and they really gave her a performance platform to play the Uilleann pipes. And she's a great presence, and she has a number of tours around Ireland, but she also got to play abroad. She also got to play in Wales and in England as well. And her diaries really are an important source of information for us, where we see the extensive touring schedule that she did have. But she was also part of the revolution. They had a safe house in Cork City, and she carried guns and ammunition. So she really had no fear. She was a very inspiring woman.
Yeah, there's a lovely scene in the documentary, in fact, where you get to play Mae McCarthy's pipes. And I got the distinct impression watching this, Louise, that you actually found it very emotional, that moment.
Well, definitely, because I suppose as a musician, the Uilleann pipes are an extension of yourself or of your person. And I had researched, I've been researching this for the last 5 or 6 years, and all the filming process was done in real time. And so right up to the previous day, I didn't know, because of COVID, whether I was going to get to see the pipes or not. And you know, when you're researching something like this, you're so passionate about it that you're to connect to actually the physical instrument and to see it there in front of you was really like, I know I said it on the documentary, was really like having Mae McCarthy in the room because they hadn't sounded for so long. And I suppose the set is so historic as well. It goes right back to the mid-1800s. And so bringing all that history together, bringing Mae McCarthy's history and bringing it all into the room together, I think both myself and Mary Mitchell felt the same, that there was something particularly moving about it.
Let's have a listen to a clip from the documentary, in fact, and this features the wonderful Paddy Maloney and Betty Nevin, who was one of very few young women playing the pipes in the group that Paddy Maloney and others, all of them pupils of Leo Rosam. Let's have a listen to the two of them together, Paddy Maloney and Betty Nevin.
Did you ever feel shy or nervous on stage as a little girl amongst all these boys?
Well, I used to wish there was another girl, really, you know, but they were all great. But I was the only woman with all those boys, and they could be devils when they liked, you know, and they're not Paddy. But some of them, like, could be carrying on in the hotels we were in. See, Paddy was only the baby in Ardlo.
I know, you looked after me very well.
What's the age difference between the two of you?
One year. I'm a year older than Paddy, I think. I'll be 84 this year.
I mean, she was an absolutely gorgeous player. And, you know what I mean, to be part of the whole scene going on, you know, with the first Flack Hole and that sort of thing. She was a gem. You know, she was very important, you know. She was an icon there, you know.
The beautiful Paddy Maloney there, speaking of Betty Nevin, who was sitting next to him on the sofa as he was saying this, but you could hear the genuine admiration for her. We're talking about Manana Babe, a T.G. Cahir documentary. Louise McCahy presents it, and it's still available on the T.G. Cahir player. When we were talking about Cork Irish Pipers Club, I meant to get you to read a little bit of the report. What newspaper is this from? I think you came across this yourself, Louise.
That's right. There's two really interesting quotations. There's one from the Cork Irish Pipers Club, the Gael newspaper from December 1901. And this is where it documents Anna Barry as being the catalyst for piping and for inspiring other women. I'll read it for you and your listeners. It says, the chairperson congratulated the committee on the great success of the working of the club. A large number of young ladies and gentlemen had joined since the winter session had set in, and no less than six young ladies have now joined the pipes class, owing to the good example set by Miss Barry, who has shown to sceptical persons that this ancient musical instrument can, with advantage, be mastered by the gentler sex possessing a musical ear.
I know. I don't know where you start with that, except by saying, well, it was December 1901. Let's just say that. Please tell me that it is totally different now, or am I being too positive to think that it's totally different, Louise?
Sean, we're at a really exciting time in Illan piping and in Illan piping history. There are a lot more girls playing the instrument, both here in Ireland and abroad. And if you go to any Illan pipe workshop or any class around the country or concerts, we see a greater visibility, a greater presence of women. And we also see a lot more of all ages taking up the instrument. And that's a really really positive step in the history of Illan piping.
All right. Well, listen, lovely to speak with you this evening. Louise, and that's Louise McCahy talking about the documentary Manon the Babe, available to view now on the TG Cahir player. If you go to TG4, obviously TG4, the numeral is the website, tg4.ie. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy researched the programme for us this evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will be with you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1.